Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, advocates are pushing for a statewide heat safety standard for workers that is actually enforceable.
And we'll take a look back at a time when young adult fiction was not a separate genre.
But let's begin this morning at the state capitol, where lawmakers are getting ready for a vote on some controversial issues, from cameras in nursing homes to protecting historic neighborhoods from development. Here to tell us about some of what is coming up in the coming week, as he does every Monday during the legislative session, is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning there, Howie.
Good morning. Good morning. Yes, I love working on live technical radio issues.
Always an adventure. Okay, but let's begin this morning, Howie, with nursing homes. This is an interesting measure. Lawmakers are advancing a proposal to say that a person living in a nursing home or an assisted living facility is entitled to put live cameras in it. What would this measure do?
This is designed to recognize the fact that while we all hope that we'll end up in a nursing home or an assisted living facility where everything is just great, it doesn't always happen that way. So what this says is there should be a way that if I go into a nursing home facility, I can put up a camera that A, could videotape what's going on a 24/7 basis, or B, send a live feed to my relatives and they could watch out, because if in fact I am being abused, I am being neglected, I'm being abandoned, as the case of one lawmaker said, that the relatives can actually do something about that. Now, this has provoked some controversy with the industry where they say, well, this is our private property and you can't tell us what to do. Well, to which Representative Wynn said, hey, we tell you to put in fire protection and feed the residents, so this is no different. Now, there are some protections built in.
Right.
If you have a roommate, you need the roommate's consent. This is not in the public areas. It allows the residents to turn off the cameras if, in fact, they're doing something that they really don't want streamed out on the World Wide Web.
Yeah.
But it does seem to have very broad support, although similar bills have failed in the last couple of years.
Okay. I want to turn now to some of Phoenix's and Tucson's most sought-after neighborhoods, right? These historic neighborhoods. And they have that kind of official designation. This is all about creating an exemption, basically, for these neighborhoods from the so-called middle housing legislation that passed through just a few years ago.
Exactly. There have been various efforts by lawmakers to make housing more affordable. And so, for example, we have a bill on casitas. So if you have a home and you have sufficient property, you can put one or two, you know, grandmother houses, if you want to call them mother-in-law houses, on your property, and you can rent them out. There are things to require cities to speed up construction of homes and get through all of the permitting process. This is designed to say if you have areas within the inner city, which means bus service, maybe light rail service, that if it's zoned for single-family homes, that you also have to allow duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, townhomes there.
Right.
Makes a lot of sense if you have vacant land. The concern is that you have certain areas. Think about, you know, Willow, Encanto, FQ Story, things like that here in Phoenix,
right,
where somebody may say, well, heck, if I buy this old house, I can tear it down and put up a fourplex. And that has caused, obviously, some great concern. So they're trying to work out a compromise to say, okay, we'll amend last year's law and say, we'll give cities some ability to say, you can't just tear down historic homes, but yet preserve the idea that we do want urban infill, because it makes more sense than building things on the west side of Buckeye.
Right, right. And they're looking at some kind of middle ground, essentially, there, because there is an affordable housing problem in the city.
Exactly. And, you know, whether this is a solution, I don't know. I mean, there's other market forces at work. We know, for example, right now that what landlords can demand for rent is down. Is that an overbuilt market? You know, hard to say. You know, there's no one solution to all of this.
Okay. Let's talk quickly, Howie, about another measure from Republican Senator T.J. Shope. He wants to raise the age that judges are allowed to serve. Right now, they can serve until they're 70. This would raise it to 75. What's the thinking here?
Well, prior to 1974, when they put in merit selection of judges for Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, and the larger counties, there was no age limit. You'd go out, you'd campaign, and if people liked you, you got reelected.
Right.
You know, the U.S. Supreme Court, obviously, federal courts have no age limit. The thinking is, when did we decide that 70 was the point at which the cheese falls off the cracker? I mean, look, I'm 75. I'd like to believe that you're not going to put me out to pasture, you know, or send me to a farm upstate, as the old saying would go.
We would never do that, Howie.
I reached that age. So at the very least, I think there's a belief that 75 is an appropriate age. Should it be 80? Again, I'm 75. I'm now too old to serve as a justice on the Supreme Court or any court at all.
All right.
Interesting question, given we have an aging population, but a lot of people are living longer and they're not necessarily just sitting in nursing homes, you know, waiting for something to happen.
Yeah. All right. Last 30 seconds, Howie, before we let you go, have a quick question about Easter. I have a whole lot of these ever-hated marshmallow peeps sitting around at my house now. And I hear you got some advice on what to do with those from a certain former Arizona governor.
Yes. When Jan Napolitano was governor back in 2008, and we were talking to her, it was during Easter, and she was having regular press briefings. You know, they used to do that, you know, as opposed to current governors. She said, look, if you've got leftover peeps, I know something you can do. Take a pair of these peeps, usually chicks, although it works with the rabbits, and you put a toothpick in each one. Put them on a paper plate, and the toothpick has to be facing forward, like a lancet, like you were jousting. And you put them in the microwave, and they tend to blow up, and you can have a contest between the peeps, and depending on how they heat, one will probably lunge forward and impale the other, and that is the winner.
All right.
Of course, you're just as likely to be left with a mess on your plate.
A good advice for those peeps from former Governor Janet Napolitano. Howie Fisher, Capital Media Services. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, gas prices are always on our minds here in the Valley, where many people are dependent on their cars to get around. But with gas prices skyrocketing as a result of President Trump's attack on Iran, officials are scrambling for ideas to control costs. That is particularly urgent with summer approaching. Gas stations in many states, including Arizona, are required to switch to a different blend of gas in hotter months, which is more expensive to produce. Senator Ruben Gallego has been lobbying the federal government for a waiver on that requirement this summer. To explain what this summer blend is and why it exists, we are joined now by Robert Rapier, a chemical engineer who also writes about energy issues. He covered summer blends in a recent piece for Forbes. Robert, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you for being here. To start, Robert, tell us why summer blend gas exists in the first place.
Okay, so this goes back to the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, and it was a result of smog in a lot of different densely packed cities. And gasoline blenders from then had to meet two specific requirements. They've got to meet the octane. Everybody's familiar with octane. You put it in your car, depending on what your car needs, and that stays constant all year round. But the other very important specification is called reed vapor pressure, RVP. And basically what that means in layman's terms, it is the tendency to evaporate. It's how easily it evaporates. And so in winter, when it's cooler, we can have a blend, a gasoline blend, with a higher RVP. So it would evaporate faster in summer, but in winter, it evaporates more slowly because it's cold. And the reason this is important is butane is a major component of this blend. Butane is abundant, it's cheap, and so that makes the winter blends a lot cheaper to produce. And it's also off-season, so it's off-demand season. So we got all these three factors contributing to generally make winter gasoline less expensive. And then the inverse happens in the spring as summer driving season is starting to heat up and the temperature starting to heat up, the RVP specification goes down. And so that means that gasoline blenders have to get that butane out. And that means supplies have now been cut because you can't put the butane in there. A cheap ingredient is coming out, and it's all coming when high demand season is about to kick off. So that's why we have it, and that's why the gasoline prices spike as we head to summer every year.
Okay. So very quickly, Robert, listeners may have heard that the EPA announced a fuel waiver recently, which will allow gas stations to sell fuel blended with ethanol. Is that the same thing as these cleaner burning blends that you're describing?
So it has it's related. So ethanol is a component that is blended into gasoline. And one of the things ethanol does when you blend it in is raises the vapor pressure. And so it's a consideration as well. As you're moving into the summer months and that vapor pressure requirement drops, you have to reduce the amount of ethanol that goes in. And so what they've said, and it's probably a little too late to have an impact this year because gasoline blenders are already reducing the inventory in their tanks from the winter blends. This turnover takes a little bit of time. And so they have to get ahead of it. They have to be completely all high vapor pressure gasoline has to be out of the system by the turnover date. And so they probably don't have enough time for it to make a major impact at this point. But there is no free lunch. I mean, what happens is this contributes to smog. I mean, that's the reason it was done. And if you want to know the impact, just look at Los Angeles. I mean, this is a major contributor to Los Angeles air quality being so much different between the 1970s and today. I mean, 1970s, Los Angeles air was brown. And because of these new requirements, these seasonal requirements, that's helped clean up the air. And it's the case with any densely populated city that has warm summer temperatures.
Yeah. Well, I know one of those. It's called Phoenix. let me ask you this. We have just about 30 seconds left here, Robert. Senator Gallego, as I mentioned, has been advocating for a waiver on these blends for Arizonans this summer. He claims it could save drivers 40 to 50 cents a gallon. Is that accurate?
That's probably an overestimate, but it could definitely save money. But again, there's no free lunch. I mean, our air quality here is generally not that great, and that will worsen air quality. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, no free lunch, but lots of good information from our guest, Robert Rapier, who is a chemical engineer and a writer on energy issues. Robert, thank you for this conversation.
You bet.
Good morning. You're listening to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, books centering the experiences of middle schoolers and teens have their own section in a library or a bookstore, but that's a relatively recent change in the book world.
But first,
Arizona's notorious heat has a lot of consequences, but perhaps one of the most overlooked is its impact on workers who are exposed to it every day. Think about working on a construction site in the Arizona summers, or in a field, or delivering your mail, for that matter. In fact, it's estimated more than 1 million Arizonans work in industries that regularly expose them to extreme heat on the job. And Arizona's outdoor workers face some of the hottest conditions in the country. But the state has never had any specific regulations requiring their employers to provide them with water, shade, or training to protect them from the heat. Now, labor rights groups in Arizona are calling for change. They want an enforceable heat safety standard like California and six other states have adopted. And this week, the Industrial Commission of Arizona is expected to discuss recommendations for workplace heat safety in the state. KJZZ's Catherine Davis-Young has been steeped in all of this as she's been reporting a series on workers and the heat that launches today. And she joins me now to talk more about it. Good morning, Katie.
Hi there.
Okay, so advocates have been pushing for this enforceable heat standard. The governor formed a task force to work with Arizona's Division of Occupational Safety and Health. This is ADOSH, to come up with heat guidelines for employers. So what did they come up with?
Right. So there was this task force that the governor called for last year. And in December, this group that represented all these different industries, there were 24 members of the group, they submitted their recommendations to the state. And what they came up with was recommendations that work sites should have heat illness prevention plans, they should have water available for workers and shade, and they should have acclimatization periods for new workers and a lot of training. training around heat safety. But the recommendations did not have any mention of how this should all be enforced. And so that's the bit that was really disappointing to labor groups, who say that unless employers are held accountable, these guidelines won't do much to prevent heat illnesses or deaths.
Okay. So that's where we kind of stand now. Let's back up and talk about what this looks like for real life workers all across the state. You dug into the data here to try to find out, like, how many workers here actually die from heat exposure. And it wasn't easy to find, it sounds like.
Right. There's really sparse data on this. There's no like one database anywhere that I can go to that just tracks all these cases. And OSHA on a national level actually estimates that for every heat-related worker death that we know about, there are probably about 14 cases that don't get reported. So on a nationwide scale, OSHA estimates there's probably more than 500 heat-related worker deaths per year, plus tens of thousands of illnesses and injuries. But those are pretty hard to track.
Okay, so you did your own kind of investigation to identify workers in Arizona who have died. How did you go about that?
Yeah, so I dug into a lot of OSHA accident and fatality records and kind of cross-referenced those with local medical examiner records, and then also was able to dig into a lot of like historical heat data to look at the weather on these different days. So I identified about two dozen cases going back to the 1980s in Arizona. We know there are probably many more out there. That's probably just the tip of the iceberg. But these cases do happen. There are quite a lot of deaths out there in Arizona that seem to be related to heat exposure on the job.
Okay. So tell us about some of the deaths you were able to find, Katie. You know who, when, you know, ages, things like that.
Yeah. The most recent case that I found was from September of last year. So just a few months ago, a 56-year-old postal worker named Leonard Perez collapsed and died along his route delivering mail in the Phoenix area. It was 106 degrees that day. The medical examiner's report said that he did have some underlying cardiovascular health issues that would have made him very vulnerable to heat illness, but they did list heat exposure as one of the contributing factors in his death.
Yeah.
One of the reasons this case stands out is because Perez was only about 3 weeks into his job. So you hear labor groups and researchers talking a lot about acclimatization in these cases. The body really does need time to adjust. There were actually several cases that I found looking at these deaths that someone was new to the job. Another case that stood out to me goes all the way back to 1998. It was a farm worker, and the OSHA fatality report actually classified this as like a tractor accident. The farm worker had fallen from the tractor and was run over and killed.
Ooh.
But when you read a little bit more into the details of the report, this was in the middle of July. It was a 112 degree day. And the report says that the reason that he fell from the tractor was most likely heat exhaustion. So there is a lot of research to suggest that it's not just heat-related deaths, heat stroke that kills people on the job. There are all these other types of accidents and injuries that also increase when temperatures rise. So I think this was a pretty clear example of that.
Yeah, makes sense. So Katie, I mean, we know that temperatures in Arizona are only getting hotter. We're experiencing that right now. The heat season is lasting longer as well. Is there any evidence that these deaths are becoming more frequent because of climate change?
Yeah. So one of the people that I interviewed for this story was Emma Torres. She's the director of Campesinos Sin Fronteras, which is a farm worker rights organization based out of Yuma. And just anecdotally, she's been working with farm workers for decades, but she feels like just in the last few years, there's been a lot more concern around heat.
For years and years, people had been exposed to heat and they had found ways to, you know, protect themselves, wearing a big hat or, you know, drinking water all the time. But what they're reporting is that more and more it's worse.
So data actually backs up what Torres has observed anecdotally. A lot of these farm workers are going to work before dawn, but overnight temperatures are rising really fast. So now they're going to work more often in like 90 degree weather. There's also research recently in the journal Health Affairs that shows the rate of outdoor worker deaths in Arizona is rising. And it's rising faster than in California, where there have been these heat safety regulations in place since 2005. So it appears that regulations can really make a difference here.
Interesting. Okay. You also did a lot of reporting on employers and kind of their side of things. What do they have to say about all of this? What did they tell you?
I've talked to employers from a few different industries. I spent some time out on a construction site in Mesa, talking to a company there. They take a lot of precautions around heat. They already do a lot of these things that the state could potentially ask for around providing water and shade. So that company I talked to was, you know, comfortable with the idea of making these regulations. They feel like they would already be meeting or exceeding whatever it is that the state might ask for.
Yeah.
The one industry group that has been kind of outspoken, not in favor of regulations, is the Arizona Farm Bureau. Hmm. I think farmers deal with a lot of variables. The word that kept coming up when I talked to the Farm Bureau was flexibility. They have to be able to react to changes in rainfall and fertilizer prices and all these other market pressures. And, you know, their crops have to get picked when they're ready. It doesn't really matter if it's 80 degrees that day or 100 degrees that day. So I think the concern that the Farm Bureau has is that adding a lot of regulations might slow down the process or burden farmers in some way that would be really challenging for their industry. And their position is just that there are already safety measures in place and worker safety is a priority. But if you go and start regulating things, that it might just kind of become a burden.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. KJZZ's Catherine Davis Young. Thanks so much, Katie. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nearly every student in Phoenix's Osborne School District eats school lunch every day. That's almost twice as high as the statewide average. And that's on purpose. Corey Alexander is director of child nutrition in the district and has been making a concerted effort to incorporate more scratch cooking and locally sourced ingredients into meals there. He's also been working to find funding to make those things possible. Sarah Schwartz wrote about Alexander and his work in the Osborne District for Education Week. She talked about it with our co-host, Mark Brody.
So I want to start with one of the opening lines of your piece when you talked to Corey Alexander and asked him like to describe what he does. And you quoted him as saying he manages six successful small restaurants in Central Phoenix. What did that tell you about what he was trying to achieve in this school district?
Yeah, he has this vision for what school lunches can be that I think is so different from what you or I might remember as school lunches from our youth. I think there's this perhaps unfounded idea that there's a lot of prepackaged food, that maybe there's some mystery meat involved. And that's really what Corey was trying to move away from. He wanted to see meals that were tasty, that were healthy, that students would really want to eat. And also, he had a vision for how to treat staff in a way that treated them as professionals and as food service professionals.
So how did he go about trying to do this? Because it would seem as though making school lunches more nutritious and tastier would take a lot of money.
Yeah, so doing what he has done, which is bringing in a lot more scratch cooking and bringing in more local ingredients, that is expensive. And it's something that's hard for a lot of districts to do. A big part of how he was able to make this change, he told me that back when he was a coordinator for the program, before he was director, he was a big part of pushing for enrolling the district in something that's called the Community Eligibility Provision. And this is a federal program that allows schools to serve free meals to all kids and get reimbursed for every meal served. So not just the kids at the school who would qualify for free or reduced meals, but every kid at the school. Hmm. And you can do that if a certain threshold of your students would already qualify for those free meals. And that was the case in Osborne. So when they were able to enroll in that program, it upped the number of students who were participating, who were taking breakfasts and lunches, which then increased their revenue. And it also freed up some administrative time, which allowed Corey to then do things like seek out community partnerships or find community farms that he could partner with to bring in local ingredients, think about how to do more scratch cooking, those kinds of things.
Yeah, I'm curious how those conversations went when he would go to a farm or, you know, you wrote about how he worked with a cattle rancher to get beef in the schools. And obviously, there's a lot of farms, a lot of ranches in Arizona with whom to work. But as you also write, like sometimes the economics on that don't always work out when you're talking about a school district.
Yeah, so a lot of local producers might not be used to working with school districts. They may not have before, which was the case for this ranch that Corey formed a partnership with. It's called K4 Ranches. They're in Prescott. And now they do actually work with more school districts after having started that partnership with Corey. But they had to do some negotiations between Corey and the Osborne School District and K4 Ranches to figure out how they could get the price down to a point that would be sustainable for the school district. Initially, some of that was grant funded through a federal grant program that actually no longer exists. But Osborne is figuring out ways now to be able to keep that partnership going.
So what are some of the top dishes that have come out of this that the staff enjoys preparing and the students enjoy eating?
This is one of my favorite parts of reporting the story, hearing about all the cool food that they're making there. So they make a picadillo completely from scratch. They make beef and broccoli. They make burritos. They make mac and cheese. Apparently, there is a district-wide famous chicken pot pie that they make. they make the dough themselves. They make the filling themselves. And then they also did this past, a few months ago, they did a special series of meals for school lunch week. And they did a scratch-made veggie ramen that apparently kids are actively asking them to bring back, which I thought was cool.
Yeah, wow. Are there concerns about federal cuts? I mean, so many federal programs have seen funding cuts over the last number of months. Is this program potentially one of them?
Yeah, so I mentioned that grant program that that Osborne was able to use to initially start up that partnership with K4 Ranches. That was a grant program, a federal grant program that supported farm-to-school partnerships. It was nationally about $660 million in federal grants. The Trump administration canceled that program in 2025, and there was reporting at the time about how that was affecting school districts and causing them to have to cancel some of these partnerships that they had rolled out. That's not the case in Osborne. They're figuring out ways to make that partnership keep working going forward. But when I spoke with Corey, he did say that we're in a pretty uncertain situation where we don't really know how things with federal funding are going to change going forward or what that might look like. And so it's just meaning that he's having to spend more time than usual working on contingency plans and ways to make sure that things can keep moving forward despite that uncertainty.
Is this kind of thing replicable? Like, is this something that other school districts, not just in Arizona, but across the country could, in theory, do?
When I talked to experts in this field about this, they were saying that Osborne is an example of a district that is kind of doing everything right, but it's not something that other districts couldn't do. There are some barriers to doing things like this. With scratch cooking, a lot of the barriers come down to facilities and staff. So there are factors about school kitchens that I had never thought about before that could prevent you from doing scratch cooking, things like not having enough outlets to be able to plug in all of the equipment that you would need. Mm. And then there's also a lot of staff turnover in school kitchens, usually because there is there's more competitive pay in other food service jobs outside of schools.
All right. That is Sarah Schwartz, a reporter for Education Week. Sarah, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Last week, I spoke to KJZZ contributor Amanda Kerberg about why Phoenix can be a tricky place to make friends. It's a question I started thinking about in part because of the significant number of people I'd seen on social media platforms posting call-outs for community, just openly asking the internet for friends. Jalen Layfield noticed this too, and he decided to head to social media himself and try to do something about it. Here's a clip from a video he posted on his TikTok channel, Jay's Conversations, back in December.
If you live in the Phoenix area and you've been looking for something to do, I got just the thing for you. In 2026, we are launching a Conversations Club. Each month, between January and May, we'll read some sort of literature, watch some sort of media source on our own, and then we'll have an experience that we'll do together. For January, for example, we're going to go to a museum, and then afterwards, we'll meet up to talk about it.
Jalen lives and works here in Phoenix. He moved here about 2.5 years ago. His conversation club is now in its fourth month, and Jalen takes it very seriously. On his website, he posts a monthly syllabus, articles to read, movies to watch. He's hosting an upcoming screening of Judas and the Black Messiah, for example. And starting this weekend, he's opening a brick-and-mortar bookstore in Tempe's cul-de-sac neighborhood, where he'll have books for sale that the club has talked about. He also hopes it will become a destination for gatherings and, of course, conversation. It's a lot to manage, but as Jalen told me recently, he welcomes that challenge. He said he knew from the response to his TikTok video that people were craving something like this.
The response was amazing. I had about like 900 responses on like a Google form.
900 responses?
900.
So that to me suggests a significant desire for something like what you're doing in Phoenix. What has been your experience of the process of making friends, getting social groups together in Phoenix? Have you found it difficult personally?
Yes, I found it very difficult personally. So I'm from Georgia, and then I moved to LA to go to school. And after school, I graduated and I moved to Phoenix, and I didn't know anybody in Phoenix. And I started working in corporate America, and I was like, okay, like, where are my people at? And people, for some reason, don't seem to be as open to engage in community, although everybody here seems to want it.
Did you try when you started your corporate job to seek out this kind of interaction with coworkers, or did it seem like they just weren't into it?
I have very like strict boundaries when it comes to like work personal. So like I don't seek out, let's say, like these sorts of interactions with coworkers.
Tell me more about that.
Yes. It's just something that I have maybe learned, or something that I've put up for myself in terms of just like, hey, when I'm at work, I don't want to bleed into my personal life too much, just because if we're being honest, like my club and like what I represent and like what I talk about are things that are not typically supposed to be talked about at work.
Uh-huh. So the theme for the first month of the Conversation Club was resisting fascism. I can see where that might be the kind of thing where if you bring that up to somebody at work who maybe does not agree that there is fascism to be resisted,
right,
that could be awkward for you.
Yes, very much so.
Gotcha. Can I ask, you don't have to be specific, but what kind of corporate environment do you work in?
Actually, can we not?
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. That's
okay,
fine.
Okay. Yeah.
The reason I'm interested is I have found this. I don't know how old you are, but
I'm 26.
You're 26. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm 43.
Okay.
And something that has come up for me a lot in the conversations I've had about this issue that we're driving at here is how much, speaking very generally, folks from my generation, millennials, have historically looked to coworkers for friendship.
Oh, now this is something we could talk about. Yeah. Sorry, you just like ignited something out of me.
Oh, okay, so tell me more about that.
Yes. So this is actually something that I find to be very interesting, and something that I see is millennials looking to coworkers for friendships. And I think it is also one of the reasons why I don't do that. And it's because I feel like when we work in an environment where like we have to rely on each other, and we rely on each other to like fend for ourselves, like we need our paychecks, like, you know, mortgages and bills are paid, then I think you're more willing to let some things slide. Like if I don't agree with something that you're saying, not saying that we can't disagree, but if I have like a fundamental kind of like boundary that I have in place of like, hey, I believe in this thing and you don't, I still have to like try to be friendly with you. Right, and it's right. Not something that I want to have to do. And one thing that a lot of people mentioned is that they like start to become maybe friends with someone, or they start to kind of talk to someone, and then they find out that they have this viewpoint that they fundamentally don't agree with. And people wanted a space where it's like, okay, we have a baseline. Like, I know everyone here believes in human rights, or I know everyone here believes in these fundamental things.
And this is actually a copy that you have on your website, correct?
Mm-hmm. It's like basically if you're a Trump supporter, or if you're someone who doesn't believe in fundamental like human rights, then this will not be the most productive space for you. Everybody is welcome. This is not this is something I'm like very clear about. This is not just an echo chamber of like, oh, yes. And, you know, we all disagree with each other. Like, we disagree with each other, but we do it in a respectful manner. And we also don't disagree with people's fundamental right to exist and like just live.
Can I ask, how has that played out in the gatherings you've had so far? I know you're only, as we're talking right now, this would be month 4.
Mm-hmm.
But has there been any friction about that? Or have you found it to be an echo chamber? How has that gone?
Yeah, it's literally been no friction. Like, we do disagree with each other.
About what? What are some things people have disagreed about?
Basically, somebody said something along the lines of they think that something is like physically, mentally wrong with like Trump supporters in the way that they believe in things. And I made the assertion that I don't think that's the case. I think that it's an active choice for people to support a president who is known to be an offender, like to be a terrible human being at their core. I think it's a choice.
That does sound like a very interesting conversation, I have to say.
Yes, yes. And it all, like, it wasn't the start of the conversation.
No,
of course. And then we got there, and I was like, okay.
Did that come out of one of the books or the movies that you were discussing?
Yeah, it came out of a book we were talking about, Blackdom. It was a community in New Mexico, like a black community in New Mexico, and we were reading a book on that, and that came out.
So you've been doing this for, we were just saying, this is, you're entering month 4.
Mm-hmm.
You are curating multiple events a month.
Mm-hmm.
You're maintaining a curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
You're opening a bookstore.
Right.
You also have this 9-to-5 job.
Right.
Are you losing your mind?
Absolutely. genuinely, uh-huh. Absolutely. My boyfriend not yells at me, but I drink a Celsius like every day.
Uh-huh.
And I should not. And I need to stop. But I'm genuinely, I'm so tired.
Well, part of the reason I ask is because I could imagine a version of this where you start a club like this because you kind of ultimately want it to be obsolete. You know what I mean? Like, you start a club like this as a way of fostering a bunch of connections, and then hopefully those become organic and don't necessitate the infrastructure that you've built up around this anymore. But you're really leaning into building what sounds like a really sustainable infrastructure around this.
Yes. I want both things to happen. Like, what happens is, like, I want to build this infrastructure where, like, hey, this is a community space for you all to come into, to enjoy, to engage. But also, like, when we're doing club events or we're around each other, like, exchange information and, you know, exchange numbers and Instagrams and go out and do things. Like, and that's what's been happening, which is really nice. And it's even happening on my part. I'm going to dinner with a couple from one of the club events who I really like them, and I feel like I'm like, we could be friends. And I'm going to dinner at their house, and I've gone to lunch with some other people, and I've like done things with people, and I want that to happen. And this is outside of the club, quote unquote, like environment.
Well, I have been speaking with Jalen Layfield, who is the host and founder of Jay's Conversations, which is many things. It is a podcast. It is a conversation club. And it is starting on April 11th, a bookstore at Cul-de-Sac. Jay, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. When author Tom Levine was writing one of his novels, which is called Party, he wasn't thinking in terms of genre. The book is about a group of high school students all headed to the same party to celebrate the end of the school year. The narrative shifts perspectives, telling the story from each of their points of view as the party unfolds. When it came time to market the book, Levine's agent informed him that it would be positioned as young adult fiction. Levine was fine with that, to be clear, but it also surprised him a little. When he was growing up, that genre didn't really exist, and a lot of his favorite books chronicled the inner lives of young people navigating rocky emotional territory. Levine publishes a newsletter, and he wrote about some of those books and authors recently. As he put it, books from Gen X worth your time to read or reread. I spoke to him about this, and he told me that when he was writing Party, he was channeling those books and writers.
You know, I was just trying to be honest. I was trying to capture things the way Judy Blume kind of does, which is like, hey, these are kids. This is what kids do. This is how they think and act. And we have to kind of make allowances for that. We have to give them some room to be the kids that they are.
Yeah.
But it didn't occur to me that that was a genre in and unto itself. And it didn't really exist until, I mean, I would say the early 2000s, maybe the late 90s. So it kind of came as a surprise to me when I'm here in, you know, 2008 or so, and my agent's like, this is young adult. I'm like, oh, okay.
You're like, these used to be just books.
Exactly. And back in my day, when you went to Walden Books or B. Dalton, back when you could actually have two bookstores in one mall, we had, Stephen King and then Judy Blume. That was it. So there was no middle ground for readers who were teenagers or adolescents.
Yeah. Before we get to these other books that that experience kind of inspired you to write about here, can you think of anything in Party, your book, that you felt able to write about with confidence because some of these writers that we're going to talk about today had kind of modeled it for you?
Absolutely. In the novel, there are 11 chapters, and every chapter is told from the first person point of view of a different character. Mm-hmm. So once you spend time with this character, you may see them again, but you'll only see them from someone else's point of view.
Okay.
And that was a very deliberate construction that I did, because one of the points of the book was to kind of point out we don't know everybody's whole story. And that's the thing that I felt very strongly resonated with me as a kid, and I know lots of people also felt that and still continue to feel that way as adolescents.
Well, so let's talk about some of these books that you featured in the newsletter that you sent out about this recently. One in particular that you featured it's called Maudie and Me and the Dirty Book from 1980. Why did you decide to feature that one?
Maudie and Me by Betty Miles has got to be one of my top three books of all time. I absolutely adore this book because, again, it points back to friendship and how friendships grow and develop and become so central and important to who we are, what our identity is. This is a book in which the external plot is about two middle school girls who get wrapped into a whole discussion or argument or problem issue with their town, their small town, over censorship. And so that's what kind of drives the plot. That's the narrative engine. But the story that's unfolding during this is between Maudie and the main character, Kate, and their relationship to each other.
Yeah. And what is the dirty book that they're in a debate with the town about?
So the book, to my knowledge, is a fictional book called The Birthday Dog. And The Birthday Dog has a scene in which a puppy is born. And when one of the parents finds out about this, all hell breaks loose and they think it's smutty and it's inappropriate and all this kind of thing. And that's what triggers the call for censorship of this particular book.
It's really interesting hearing you talk about this, Tom, because these are conversations that are very active in 2026.
Yeah. You know, notice that.
I mean, do you think there, for people who are concerned about efforts to censor books, particularly books that are tailored towards younger audiences, do you think there's important messaging to be found in books like Maudie and Me?
Absolutely, 100%. They really focus on how the young people are dealing with it, because it's, you know, it's a book for younger readers, so it's not about what the adults in town are doing. It's about how this censorship battle is impacting the kids and what they are coming to realize is important for them, and, you know, touching on issues of freedom of speech, for example, things like that. And doing that at this age, I think the characters are in sixth grade, and what a great time to be having those conversations.
I mean, that is such a through line for me, Tom, as I look through the list of books that you have on here, is the idea that these books raise subjects that are at the very forefront of young people's minds, particularly when they enter adolescence. You know, these are things that, you know, maybe you're starting to talk about with your friends, but can seem taboo to talk about with the adults in your life.
Yes. And I've more than once heard stories about that one kid in class who never raises their hand, doesn't say anything, doesn't want to be involved until book X, and, you know, fill in the blank, gets across their desk and they start having these conversations in class about this book. And suddenly that kid just lights up and starts talking like there's no tomorrow. And that's the great thing about it, I think, as you just pointed out, whether it's in the classroom or the family room, doesn't matter, an adolescent can talk about a book and use these characters as placeholders. They can talk around things without necessarily feeling like they're being forced to divulge, you know, personal things, or they're not comfortable talking about this topic or that topic, but they can talk about, you know, Jill and Blubber and what she did and how that made them feel.
Yeah. And Jill, I should say, is the main character, as you mentioned, in Blubber, which is by Judy Blume. That's from 1974, deals with bullying and weight stigma. You also have on the list A Taste of Blackberries by Doris Buchanan Smith from 1973, which deals with loss, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's that is a tough, tough book.
Yeah. As you put it, this slim volume wrecked thousands, if not millions, of fifth graders.
It did. I don't think it's a spoiler alert, because it's the plot of the book, right? But there are two friends, and one of the friends dies very suddenly and very abruptly, unexpectedly, right in the beginning of the book. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the book is about his friend coming to terms with that. It is so honest and authentic in dealing with how people respond to that kind of tragedy, especially when they're really young. These books are not exploitative, I think. Laurie Holtz Anderson once said at a book event, I think at Changing Hands, she said, it is immoral to not include hope in books for young people. And I have carried that very closely ever since I heard her say it, because she's absolutely right. We have a responsibility when we're writing for younger readers, and books like A Taste of Blackberries take that responsibility very seriously.
Well, I have been speaking with Tom Levine, who is a writer of books and a lover of books, as you can tell from this conversation. Tom is the author of The Book Party, which we talked about, as well as many others. And you can find him at his website, tomlevine.com. That's L-E-V-E-E-N, where you can also sign up to receive the newsletter that we talked about in today's conversation. Tom, thank you for this.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
All right, that'll do it for today's edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow with much more. Don't forget, you can always follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. And you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads at theshow.kjzz.org. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, and Claire Lawton is our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show is created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to The Show's podcast. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at KJZZ The Show.